Good afternoon. It's Wednesday, the 6th of March, 2024, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Mike Robinson. Joining me in the studio today, back from Africa. Welcome back, Charles Mallett, and Vanessa Bailey from Damascus. And we're going to start today with the budget. And of course, we got the usual nonsense on Twitter from the government. Here is an example, the red box with something else sitting beside it, some kind of file or other, which I presume is the budget speech. But Jeremy Hunt, very, very keen to persuade us that he was up all night, the poor child, up all night preparing this speech. It's happening right now. So I'm not going to bore anybody with the details of it. Let's just say that we should be confident that the bribe that Jeremy Hunt is presenting today is because he was up all night working so hard. The question, though, Charles, is it going to work? I mean, lots of people naively talking about it being a bit ridiculous that he is attempting to bribe people with tax cuts today of whatever form they are, while public services are being cut, as if we're getting anything positive from public services at the moment anyway. But anyway, that's what he's saying. We've got to keep in mind that while he may be giving something with one hand, local authorities are going to be taking it with the other because they're, of course, all going bankrupt at the moment. This is the House of Commons Library statement on what happens if a council goes bankrupt. What is it? They're expecting half the councils in the UK to go bankrupt over the next several years, and 10% possibly next year. In the meantime, of course, we have care homes announcing closures in council area after council area. So what is going to happen to those people? That's the question. They're being thrown out of their care homes into what? Some private care homes, how's that going to be paid for, and so on. It's amusing, they're saying that, Hunt was saying in the budget speech there, that national debt is going to fall from currently being over 100% of GDP to something like 94% of GDP by 2029. I think that's probably called inflation. It's not probably anything to do with any steps that the government is taking. But then the question is, what happens in a few months' time? I think the general election likely to be in May. What happens if or when Keir Starmer becomes the next prime minister? Will be in a better situation? I don't think so.
No, probably not. And I think for Jeremy Hunt to have the gall to prefix what he's going to say in the budget with the statement that we had to raise taxes during the COVID era is rich, especially since it's going to be people in care homes bearing the brunt yet again.
Yes, indeed. So in the meantime, back in the normality, is it normality?
Well,
because it's getting ridiculous. People going to prison now for placing stickers in places.
Yeah, or not even doing that. Yes, news that Sam Melia has been sentenced to 2 years in prison. This refers back to a story that we reported on the 31st of January here, the CPS declaring that a far-right organiser found guilty of intent to stir up racial hatred through distribution of stickers. So the offences that Sam Melia was convicted of were exactly as it says, the public order offence of intent to stir up racial hatred and also inciting racially aggravated criminal damage via, as Mike says, stickers being put up with what the CPS described as nationalist slogans. Of course, the inference there being that nationalism is a criminal offence. And what is specifically important in this is that during the trial, the judge directed the jury that this was a case concerning free speech and not the particular specific content of the stickers in question. So regardless of your views on what Sam Melia and the Patriotic Alternative might be putting forward, you really need to consider that the overall principles of the matter. So we'll just look at how this is being framed by the authorities. And here we see all over the place counter-terrorism policing, the action against counter-terrorism, prison sentence for Leeds man, intent on stirring up racial hatred. And don't forget that all of this was extrapolated from items found in his home and the inference that they could determine from that he had such intent. So here we have James Dunkley, head of counter-terrorism Northeast, These expressions of hate were an attempt to bring upset and stir up racial hatred. Well, how exactly does he know that? So he's essentially suggesting that he's got inside the mind of Sam Melia in order to determine this. And he goes on to say that those that seek to bring hatred to our communities through actions such as stickering will be identified and brought to justice. Well, Patriotic Alternative, who obviously covered the story to date, had put out a post on their website saying that Sam Melia has been jailed for telling the truth. And I've now got a video clip of Sam's wife, Laura, and Mark Collett of Patriotic Alternative speaking outside the Crown Court after the sentencing. So please have a look at this.
I just want to say that I don't want cuddles, I don't want condolences, I don't want thoughts and prayers. I want people to get off their arses and fill the gap and the void that Sam has left. You know, Sam will be hopefully out in about 8 months. He's not leaving this struggle, I'm not leaving this struggle. If you can't be face out, that's absolutely fine. There's things that you can do behind the scenes. This is why we do what we do, because our people are persecuted for standing up for their own interests. So it's up to you now. If I can do this when I'm pregnant and having a baby in a month, and I've got another toddler, and I've got a family business to run, and a husband in prison, and a house to run, you can do something. So no more excuses. It's time for people to get up off their asses, and I look forward to seeing you at the next event. Mark?
Today, we've witnessed what has to be one of the greatest miscarriages of justice in British history. This is absolutely shocking. A man has been sentenced to 2 years in jail with immediate effect, i.e. not suspended, for putting up stickers that the Crown admitted, firstly, contained only lawful speech, and secondly, did not lead to any criminal acts. They did not incite anyone to do anything. So there was really no case against him. The only case was that the Crown wanted to punish him because they felt his supposed motivations were racism. Now, that to me is the definition of a thought crime.
So I think, first of all, we should note Laura's indomitable spirit there. And as I say, this really does concern the principle of the matter, as Mark articulates, with the suggestion that this is really a sentencing for thought crime. And Brian spoke on Monday about the Rishi Sunak's extraordinary address with its redacted political content concerning extremism and the apparent rise of extremism. But really, where is the documented evidence and delivered in an impartial fashion to suggest that this is actually the case? Where is this coming from? And so we'll just focus on one of the individuals involved, which is Lord Walney, the former Labour MP, John Woodcock, going back to 2020, announced as an independent advisor. Now, I've highlighted the independence of Walney. We'll just look at the statement from that time. The coronavirus pandemic has coincided with an increase in activity and prominence among far right, far left and other political groups. Well, that's incredibly disingenuous because, of course, the fabricated or probably fabricated pandemic itself had absolutely nothing to do with the reaction. It was to do with the supposed response and the authoritarian measures taken by a government ruling by diktat. It goes on to say, Walney will examine the points at which activities of such groups can cross into criminality. Well, again, in Parliament, that there is now the constant refrain of introducing new offences. So behaviours that had previously not been considered criminal may now be done so by new legislation. It goes on, the independent review of Prevent will continue to provide the required scrutiny of the UK's approach to countering violent extremism. So Prevent, of course, active very much in schools and education and targeting the youth, where, of course, these sorts of ideological suppositions are best placed to sort of get in there early. So we'll just look at the government website, reporting extremism in education. Well, what exactly do they mean by that? The government's definition of extremism, the vocal or active opposition to our fundamental values, including...
Our fundamental values, well, that's the government's fundamental values.
Exactly so, yes. Including democracy, the rule of law, individual liberty, and the mutual respect and tolerance of different faiths and beliefs. We also regard calls for the death of members of our armed forces as extremists. So, well, Mike, quite correctly talks about what is meant by our fundamental values. The other thing is that mutual respect and tolerance of different faiths and beliefs, but to what point, to what extent? And also, ironic, really, sort of disturbingly ironic, talking about the death of members of our armed forces, just as conscription is being sort of wafted around in the corridors of Parliament. So the other thing I would draw your attention to in relation to this is an excellent interview that Debbie Evans put on, published back in January, Prevented Education, Controlling the Narrative in Colleges and Universities. She explains exactly in detail how the Prevent strategy does affect at the youth level. And I really would encourage you to listen to that if you haven't already. So now what we'll do is we'll just go back to Lord Walney to see exactly what it is that we are viewing when we consider him to be an independent advisor. Here he is on LinkedIn, very much selling himself here, introducing Lord Walney's services. So he's effectively sort of open to bidding. And then we go to the House of Lords Register of Interests, members of the House of Lords. And here we see that he is a director of the Jewish Community Media Trust. And not just that, but also he's a person with significant control of a company for the same Jewish Community Media Trust. And of course, he has shareholdings here too. And when it comes to overseas visits, the only one he has listed is a visit to Israel on the 2nd to 7th of January of this year. So the point is that it's not necessarily especially relevant that all of these concern Israel or Jewish cultural issues, but really that he is being put forward as an independent and impartial advisor where extremism is concerned. And yet we're hearing from not just the Prime Minister, but also the head of the Metropolitan Police Service, that extremism and anti-Semitism are in effect being conflated to suggest that there's enormous overlap between the two. And we see quite clearly that such a person as Lord Walney can in no way be described as independent. So, Mike, I don't know what your take is on this and where you see this sort of push for describing so many people now as being extremist is going.
Well, one point I would make is that, you know, going back a lot of years when we were talking about Prevent, when Prevent was mainly focused on so-called Islamic extremism, lots of people were saying that's okay because it's Islamic extremism that it's there to deal with. We're now finding that other people expressing other views are now being classified as extremist. And suddenly we're finding Prevent being applied in that direction as well. And of course, it is a trap that people always fall into. They see a piece of legislation which happens to coincide with a particular issue that they imagine in their minds. That's okay for that piece of legislation to go ahead, whether it be censorship or whatever it happens to be, until, in fact, it suddenly the focus moves in another direction. Mm. We've got to recognize when a piece of legislation is draconian or totalitarian, and we've got to oppose it, whether the initial destination of that legislation is to a group that we don't particularly like ourselves. We've got to recognize what that is and oppose it. And I think this is a good illustration of that. Yeah,
absolutely. And I think the only thing I didn't point out at the time is it's interesting to see, going back to 2020, how the appointment of Lord Walney refers to far left extremism, which has now been completely dropped from the narrative, and you can only be on the far right.
Vanessa, let me welcome you to the program. And we're going to have a look at Israel and its use of technology.
Yeah, I mean, what I wanted to try and do, because I started to look into it in the last few days, is to show the crossover between basically what Israel has been doing for some time to Palestinians in Gaza and in the occupied territories, and what our governments are doing to us, and how the Israeli technology perhaps connects in to what our governments are doing to us. So this article was published a couple of days ago, Israel's e-warfare using smartphones to kill the Lebanese resistance. And from within the article, there is a link to an article in L'Orient today It's not only about monitoring phone calls, messages, and so on. Your mobile smartphone is connected to the internet and has microphones, which Israel can enable remotely to listen to all conversations and can also record everything happening through the mobile's cameras. Now, from personal experience, when I entered Gaza in 2012, and obviously I was given a SIM card that clearly is it emanates from Israel, I was receiving text messages from the IOF. So they were perfectly aware of who I was and my telephone number. But just going back to the Cradle article, what it actually points out in the next slide. So to counteract Israeli surveillance, the Lebanese resistance has been active in dismantling radar and spy systems on the border with Lebanon. However, Israel has now turned to utilizing cameras placed in homes, neighborhoods, and streets, often by penetrating existing surveillance networks in an effort to thwart these tactics. Hezbollah has urged residents of border towns in southern Lebanon to disable surveillance cameras, which I presume also include CCTV. This is in addition to suspicious calls from individuals claiming to represent official or private associations, seeking information about family members or inquiring about specific individuals. And several homes have faced Israeli shelling following such calls. Then the following infograph is from an organization called Visualizing Palestine. You can find them on Twitter. So they talk about Israel's use of AI-driven warfare, automating genocide. They mention a few of the systems that I've actually looked at. But you'll see that the Alchemist and the Gospel, both of them sort of enabling the targeting of civilians in particular in Gaza, emanate from, were created by Unit 8200, the infamous Israeli spy unit. Now, having a look at the Gospel, which was reported by 972 Mag, which is an Israeli media outlet, and by The Guardian, how Israel uses AI to select bombing targets in Gaza, but also enables them to increase the number of targets on a set basis. But that's not all they do. Let's have a look at the Blue Wolf technology, the new Israeli espionage technology against Palestinians, which was then relabeled Red Wolf, an automated Israeli occupation. And then if we look at what that actually does, so the Red Wolf is deployed at military checkpoints in the city of Hebron in the occupied West Bank, where it scans Palestinians' faces and adds them to vast surveillance databases without their consent. Sounding familiar yet? The Israeli authorities are using sophisticated surveillance tools to supercharge segregation and automate apartheid against Palestinians. In the H2 area of Hebron, we documented how a new facial recognition system called Red Wolf is reinforcing draconian restrictions on Palestinians' freedom of movement using illegitimately acquired biometric data to monitor and control Palestinian movements around the city. And that came from Agnes Callamard, Amnesty International's Secretary General. Then from an article in the Washington Post, while developed countries around the world impose alleged restrictions on photography, facial recognition, and surveillance, the situation described in Hebron constitutes a severe violation of basic rights, such as the right to privacy, as soldiers are even incentivized to collect as many photos of Palestinian men, women, and children as possible in a sort of competition, said Ronnie Pelley, a lawyer with the Association for Civil Rights in Israel. And then going on within the Washington Post article, a separate smartphone app called White Wolf has been developed for use by Jewish settlers in the West Bank, a former soldier told Breaking the Silence. Although settlers are not allowed officially to detain people, security volunteers can use White Wolf to scan a Palestinian's identification card before that person enters a settlement, for example, to work in construction. The military in 2019 acknowledged the existence of White Wolf in a right-wing Israeli publication. In addition to Blue Wolf, or Red Wolf as it now is, the military has installed face scanning cameras in the divided city of Hebron to help soldiers at checkpoints identify Palestinians even before they present their ID cards. A wider network of closed-circuit television cameras, dubbed Hebron Smart City, provides real-time monitoring of the city's population, and one former soldier said, can sometimes even see into private homes. And then this from Middle East Eye, how Israel turned Palestine into a surveillance tech dystopia. And then just moving on to what it mentions regarding the COVID-19 pandemic, which is interesting. They say that this exacerbated the situation as Israel has used the guise of public health to roll out new invasive surveillance measures. Palestinians face severe restrictions on freedom of movement and must apply for travel permits. But in light of the pandemic, Israel last year launched a mobile application to replace in-person permitting services. And guess what? When the app was framed as a public health measure, its more insidious intentions are clear in its terms of service, which force users, Palestinians, to provide access to the data stored on their phones, such as calls and photos. Then equally, and this becomes a little bit more sinister, Israel deploys remote-controlled robotic guns in the West Bank, and I can attest to the fact that those are already in use in Gaza along the border walls. So this is from Associated Press in 2022. Twin turrets, each equipped with lens and gun barrel, were recently installed atop a guard tower in refugee cavern when young Palestinian protesters pour into the streets, hurling stones and firebombs at Israeli soldiers. The robotic weapons unleash tear gas or sponge-tipped bullets on them, witnesses say. What's interesting is a Palestinian activist has pointed out, we are not a training and simulation for Israeli companies. Now, they mention, they talk about this robotic gun as if it's only releasing tear gas or sponge-tipped bullets. But the following video, which I do want to in use recently, if we can just see that video, Mike. Very, very distressing video. Now, who makes this technology? Smart Shooter is the name of the organization. And if we look at one of the items that they produce, is this smash system, which is mounted on any rifle, enables you to select your target. It tracks the target for you and makes sure you hit it, even if you are moving and the target is moving. And guess who's just bought into this technology? The British Army is to get the counter-drone smash smart weapon sights. This was in 2023, and it provides anti-drone capabilities. Now, I would ask the question here, of course, the greatest threat perceived to Ukraine is the use of drones. So why is the British Army buying into anti-drone equipment? Now, Unit 8200, which is the unit involved in much of the production of this technology, very quickly running through their connection to us here in the West, massive data leaks in 2021. Reveal the Israeli NSO group spyware used to target activists, journalists, and political leaders globally. The Pegasus Project lays bare how NSO spyware is a weapon of choice for repressive governments. You have the connection, of course, to Infosys, the father-in-law of Rishi Sunak's wife who basically employed Yuri Levine formerly with Unit 8200. Then you have New Labour MP Damien Egan in the south, elected to the southwest of the UK, whose husband, Yossi Felberbaum, has connections to 8200. He was believed to have been recruiting for them. And then back in 2021, Keir Starmer employed a former 8200 operative to run his social media campaigns. And funnily enough, this from the Defense Mirror, guess who is excluded from the US norms for responsible use of AI in military? It does not include Israel. And I want to remind people of the 2030 roadmap for UK-Israel bilateral relations, which includes security, military, defense, cybersecurity, surveillance, health, technology, etc. So we can assume that 8200, that has its tentacles everywhere globally, will be heavily involved in this 2030 roadmap. Then I just picked up on this by the Stop the Wall organization. There is a Living Israel's High-Tech System of Oppression online conference on the 14th of March, if people want to look into this a little bit more deeply.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much for that, Vanessa. Now, I just want to remind everybody, kind of related to this, comments that Ben Wallace made a couple of years ago. This was with the launch of the latest defense review. We will ensure that we embed dual use at the heart of our capability management processes, considering how we can share defense space capabilities and outputs with other government departments, including the security and intelligence services, as well as potentially with commercial users. Now, of course, he was making that comment at the time when the British government was doing its best to get rid of Huawei from the UK's telecommunications networks. And the reason for that is because the UK's 5G networks in particular are going to be used for dual use, so military and civilian purposes, as will satellites and so on. So I thought it was a good time to remind ourselves what's going on with 5G in this country. Now, here's a little bit of video from Andy Kirby, who pushed this out in the last couple of days. The link to the full video will be in the show notes, but let's just have a look at this little clip.
So I've brought around my TinySA spectrum analyzer to see if we can actually see some signals from this thing. And you can actually see there on around 3.6 gigahertz, which is the 5G band. If we sort of hold it up here, you can see the signals get a little bit taller there. So look, there you can see on that bit at the end, that is the bit of the spectrum where 5G is. So you can see there's definitely presence there. So that's coming from that yeah. tower. Yeah. And it's obvious because if you kind of hold it up, it gets a bit taller. And the height of it is the strength. But in reality, the strength of that is pretty insignificant. So it's not beaming any harmful radiation into here.
So the point here is he's talking about 3.6 gigahertz, which is one of the two frequencies that is already being used for what's being described as 5G in the UK. But at the moment, it's only 4.5G, actually. So 700 megahertz and 3.6 gigahertz is what's being used. But Ofcom is about to auction millimeter wave. Now, they published this particular document, paving the way for improved 5G and innovative new wireless services back in November last year. Here's just a little bit of the text from it. Three categories of spectrum lots will be auctioned, 26 gigahertz lower, 26 gigahertz upper, and 40 gigahertz. Each lot will comprise of a block of 200 megahertz. Reserve prices, this is reserve prices in the auction, so this isn't what it's going to go for. Reserve prices will be £2 million for each lot of 26 gigahertz lower and upper, and £1 million for each lot of 40 gigahertz. In practice, if they take the average of what's happened in other auctions throughout Europe, £11-12 million is more likely what each of these lots is going to go for. They held a consultation with the industry, which ended at the 9th of January, about how they're going to actually run this auction. So they've had feedback from that, and it's imminent now that will happen. So that's where we are with 5G at the moment. Millimeter wave still not rolled out in the UK, but coming very, very soon. But the question is, what's coming next? And we need to look at this in the context of what Vanessa has just presented, because the question is, what's coming with 6G? So let's just remind ourselves, this is something that Huawei published in November 2021. This video is doing the rounds in social media at the moment. And thanks to the person who sent me this. Let's just have a look at a clip from the video that Huawei produced.
6G will serve as a distributed neural network for future intelligence of everything. Network sensing and native AI will become two new usage scenarios to fuse the physical, biological, and cyber worlds, leading to an era of connected intelligence. A rethinking of network architecture is also considered necessary to enable massive machine learning and knowledge sharing among robots. 6G will continue the journey of connected everything initiated in 5G, but with larger variety of devices, new human-machine interfaces, higher density of connections, and native trustworthiness.
So don't worry, it's going to be trustworthy natively. So that's all we need to be concerned about. Look, what's going on in Palestine? What's going on in the UK with Israeli technology? This is something we need to be paying attention to, and also with Chinese technology. And the question is this the direction that we want humanity to be going in? And I think there are many, many questions to be asked and a discussion to be had there. But let's move on. If you like what we do here at the UK Column, you'd like to support us, and we absolutely need your support. This is what keeps us going. Please head over to support.ukcolumn.org. There are options to help us out there. Of course, pick something up at the UK Column shop if you can. And as we mentioned, the MHRA t-shirt with June Rain's face on it has resulted in June Rain apparently resigning. This happened with Matt Hancock as well. Unfortunately, we didn't get the t-shirt out for Victoria Nuland, but she has obviously resigned now. But anyway, that we missed that one. So do share material you find on the various platforms, ukcolumn.org, ukcolumnextracts.co.uk especially. Brian's monologue podcast series, episode 2 of Walking the Dog, will be premiering on his YouTube channel at 11 a.m. this Sunday, the 10th of March. This is a new YouTube channel. The link will be in the description later on. Hopefully, that YouTube channel will stay up for longer than 2 weeks. But anyway, do join him at 11 a.m. for that, if you possibly can. Episode 1's on the UK Column website at the moment. A reminder of the Climate Science Masterclass with David Siegel. We only got a few more days to take advantage of early bird pricing on that. So do have a look at climatecourse.ukcolumn.org if you want to find out more. Charles will be mentioning this a little bit later in the program, but just to mention it, there's an event taking place tonight related to farming. You can see that on screen. Charles will be talking about that in more detail later. And then on the 16th of March, in the Solidarity Rally will be taking place. Drive between Archill and Trafalgar roundabout. So details, there's a QR code on screen at the moment for that. Then an evening with Richard Vogt, Sandy Adams, and Clive DeCarl taking place in Glastonbury on Saturday the 30th of March, 7 to 10 p.m. Details on screen at the moment. Okay, let's move on then to the issue of war. On Monday, Alex was talking about the leaks from Germany and their preparations apparently for war with Russia. But let's just have a look at some of the other context that leak happened in. So, of course, we've got to stop Putin. This is the message we've been hearing for the last 2 years. But on the 28th of February, Lloyd Austin said this, quite frankly, if Ukraine falls, I really believe that NATO will be in a fight with Russia. Now, that naturally, as you would expect, resulted in Russia speaking out on this. So here's Sergei Lavrov and what he had to say. The meaning of this Austin statement is that if Ukraine loses, NATO will have to go against Russia. In a Freudian slip, he blurted out what they had in mind. He said before that, everyone was saying, we can't let Ukraine lose because Putin will not stop at this and will take over the Baltics, Poland and Finland. And he said, but it turns out, according to Mr. Austin's open, unambiguous statement, it's the other way around. We do not have such plans and cannot have them, but the Americans do. And this is increasingly seems to be the case. So let's have a look around Europe as the war narrative continues to build. Complete insanity from multiple leaders around Europe at the moment. So here is Emmanuel Macron, and he was talking about getting French boots on the ground in Ukraine in the last couple of days. We'll do everything necessary to prevent Russia from winning this war, he said. Now, this did not go down very well with the French people, in fact, and 68% of them basically told Macron this is not a good idea. The French foreign minister, Stéphane Séjourné, said the French will not die for Ukraine. We will not send troops. So there seems to be division even within the French government. And in fact, Macron has now walked back somewhat from that statement, but not entirely. In the meantime, NATO's nuclear deterrent must be real for Finland, says a new president. So Finland, Finnish President Alexander Stubb, wants Finland inside NATO's nuclear umbrella. They want nuclear weapons there if possible. We've got the Polish saying, this is Radek Sikorski, the Polish foreign minister, The Telegraph reporting him with the headline, West dithering over Ukraine could spark nuclear arms race. And he's saying, if America cannot come together with Europe and enable Ukraine to drive Putin back, I fear that our family of democratic nations will start to break up. Allies will look for other ways to guarantee their safety. Some of them will aim for the ultimate weapon, starting a new nuclear race. And so it goes on. So the Atlantic Council doesn't want to be too far behind. Bowing to Putin's nuclear blackmail will make nuclear war more likely. So then we come on to this gentleman, Boris Pistorius, who of course is the German defense minister. Alex was talking about him on Monday and the German leak. And they're trying to claim that, you know, the furore over this leak is really just part of the information war that Putin is waging. There's no doubt about it. The officers were doing what they were here to do. They were thinking about different scenarios without making plans in any way. So they're trying to build a narrative which is suggesting that these guys were just having a chat, you know, nothing to worry about here, just having a chat, imagining scenarios and so on, no planning taking place at all. The Germans now saying that the leak was caused because one of the people participating in that chat, one of their military officers, was at a conference and joined the call on an insecure line which the Russians were snooping on. But he's also doubling down on trying to keep things together by saying that there's no question of anybody being asked to leave their jobs as a result. But in the meantime, NATO, now that Finland has managed to drop its neutrality and join NATO, very determined to try to encourage other European countries to do the same. So Ireland is the next target for dropping its neutrality. But of course, this is something that Ireland itself has been talking about for quite some time. So this is going back to 2023 in April. Ireland to consult public on military neutrality in wake of the Ukraine war. So Vanessa, I don't know what your thoughts are on this, but the rhetoric coming out of the West, is it too much to describe it as insanity?
No, I mean, I've been describing it as such for quite a long time, and it's very difficult to find a sane voice anywhere in the West.
Have you any thoughts?
Well, I think it's amazing how little Putin has to do in order to generate such extraordinary rhetoric sort of in his direction. And I think also the other thing that's just not really dealt with at all is declarations like Macron saying he wants to put French boots on the ground. That's insane as it may be. It's obviously vaguely realistic to be able to do that with the army that you currently have. However, I think the transition or the massive chasm between standing with Ukraine on a Facebook profile and actually turning up at a recruiting office is much, much bigger than I think any leader wants to concede.
Yes. Okay, Vanessa, let's go back to Gaza then. And of course, the Flower massacre has been generating headlines.
Just very quickly also to remind people that there were French military under siege in the Azovstal siege. So I think French military could potentially already be on the ground. Yes, the Gaza Flower Massacre, a textbook case of Israel's war crimes and cover-ups, it appears to have been, if proven, of course, one of the worst massacres of the genocidal campaign that's been ongoing since the 7th of October. In the early hours, basically, of the 29th of February, so it was around 4:30 a.m., Israeli troops opened indiscriminate fire on people waiting for a food aid delivery. Actually, it was heading towards the north, where there is a declared famine amongst the 700,000 that are sort of imprisoned in the north. Now, press TV are claiming 116 people were killed. That's in line with many other reports, and more than 760 others injured. Claims are between 200 to 400 to 760. And of course, it's very difficult to tell right now. The investigation is ongoing. But what Press TV do a good job of is demonstrating the flip-flopping by Israeli army spokespeople. For example, Rear Admiral Dan had fired a few warning shots to try to disperse a mob who'd ambushed the aid trucks. And then also they say that many of the Gazans were killed actually in the stampede. They also claimed that the trucks themselves ran over members of the so-called mob. Ben Gavir, the far-right minister, sorry, could I just go back for 1 second? Sorry. Said the Israeli soldiers acted excellently against a Gazan mob that tried to harm them. I'm not quite sure how a crowd of starving, unarmed Palestinians are going to be a threat to Israeli tanks and soldiers. But then moving on to the Palestinian accounts that basically said most of the people at the scene fell victim to Israeli gunfire, and the stampede occurred only after the Israeli troops started indiscriminately firing them. Local journalist, a reporter for a Palestinian news agency, Wafa, who witnessed the incident, said the chaos and confusion was sparked after Israeli forces opened fire, which led to people being hit by aid trucks. And another Al Jazeera journalist said that Israeli tanks advanced and ran over many of the dead and injured people. There are videos showing that online. The acting director of Al Auda Hospital said they received 161 wounded patients, most of whom appeared to have been shot. And what I want to show now is a video. It's an interview by Christian Amanpour of Mark Rajev, the Israeli spokesperson. And in the beginning of the interview, Amanpour asks Rajev, who sent the trucks into Gaza? Because the UN have basically said it wasn't under their auspices. So let's play the video.
Do you know who it was?
I know the following, that in order to help alleviate the food shortage in Gaza, that we authorized a convoy of, I think, some 30 trucks entered Gaza last night, headed for the northern Gaza Strip. And this shows that Israel is interested in seeing aid and foodstuffs reach the civilian population. Unfortunately, we saw a situation where there was a mass casualty tragedy, where it looked like the civilians were storming the trucks, trying to take the food out of desperation. A crowd was pushing and shoving, and people were killed. I can't tell you the exact numbers. I don't, as you know, don't trust the numbers put out by the Hamas-controlled Ministry of Health in Gaza. There were reports that maybe the drivers were driving over parts of the crowd. It appears to be a tragedy, but I can tell you Israel was not involved directly in any way.
When you say not involved directly in any way, what do you mean? I mean, you enabled this convoy, as you said, and your forces are there on the ground and open fire. They said it themselves. What does that mean, not involved in any way?
So we allowed the aid to come in. We are involved that way. That's our policy, to allow food to go into Gaza for the civilian population. But in the incident of people storming the trucks and the way the truck drivers behaved, and people getting squashed and pressed, and apparently there being mass casualties, Israel was not there on the ground.
Okay, but they did open fire and people were killed. So I'm completely confused by what you're saying, because they admitted, the IDF spokesman said it on our air. they open fire?
That's a separate incident.
Okay.
Not connected to the tragedy with the trucks. Uh-huh. That was different place, different time.
Now, what's interesting is that Samantha Power, the head of USAID, met with the coordinators within the Israeli military the day before. So just speculating here, did Israel send this convoy in as a bait to effectively draw out the Palestinian young men who would be the ones going to find the food and then open fire on them? We can maybe go to the last video, Mike, which just shows part of the Euromed investigation. And I just wanted to point out, when you look at these images, the IOF video footage, this was disseminated by the majority of mainstream media. And in my view, this increases the dehumanization of Palestinians, because this is the only footage seen in the mainstream media, which makes them look very much like ants. It basically objectifies them. So let's have a look at the Euromed investigation very quickly. And as you see, that will be footage from on the ground. It's certainly not the first time, of course, that civilians trying to get aid from trucks that have entered Gaza or been allowed to enter Gaza have been fired on.
Yes. Okay, thank you, Vanessa. Now let's move on. This is the anniversary of the so-called poisoning of the Skripals this week. So the last, I think the actual anniversary was Monday. So let's bring on Joanna Roper, who is the Special Representative for the United Kingdom to the Organization for Prohibition of Chemical Weapons. And so she had this to say: this week we also mark the sixth anniversary of the Novichok nerve agent attack in Salisbury. Five people were injured and Don Sturgis, poisoned in nearby Imsbury, tragically died. There are many, many questions around the death of Dawn Sturgis and what actually killed her, but that's for another time. Joanna Roper went on to say, only the Russian state had the technical means, operational experience, and the motive to carry out the attack. Well, that is a very good point. Is it true? Well, Alex Thompson doesn't quite accept that it's true. But if you go back to this article from 12th of March 2018, Skripal, a Russian web or a Rusi web, I'll just take a quote from this. He said, where CBRN, that's including chemical weapons, is concerned in the Skripal case, the organic chemistry subdomain thereof, HM government has a dedicated facility, DSTL, headquartered at Porton Down in Wiltshire, 7 or 8 miles from the scene of the discovery of the Skripals. So there are many, many questions still to be asked about this. But Joanna Roper went on to say, as we enter 2024, the work of the OPCW is more important than ever. We welcome the approval of the biennial budget. The decisions taken in November to improve the long-term viability of this crucial organization. The threat of future chemical attacks by both state and non-state actors demonstrates the need for us all to work even more intensively to ensure chemical weapon use is confined to history. Well, perhaps the way to do that is to actually be honest about the OPCW, because here we are, this article published in April last year by Dr. Piers Robinson on the UK column, 5 years on, nearly 6 years now, the OPCW Duma deception continues. And it does continue. The questions still have not been answered. And the concerns of some of the scientists from within the OPCW have still not been answered. And if you're not familiar with that case, please have a look at that article and please share it. But the OPCW has, to my mind, zero credibility until this issue is dealt with. And finally, on this, since it is the anniversary, we still need to ask the question, where are the Skripals? They have disappeared from the face of the earth. No comment since then. Are they alive? Are they dead? We have no knowledge. And maybe it's time that we did have some. Okay, where does that take us then? Back to the UK, Charles, and farming.
Indeed. A week ago, I spoke about protests or a gathering in Cardiff of Welsh farmers, which was happening at the time the news was going out. So I've got a still from a recorded video of that. There were several thousand people gathered there. And of course, it's worth pointing out that farmers have plenty of other things to be doing before deciding to trundle to Cardiff to protest. So clearly the situation is serious. And the reason for that are some of the more controversial parts of the sustainable farming scheme. The consultation, as you see from the Red Arrow, closes tomorrow, 7th of March. And essentially the bits that are being rejected, or at least sort of getting pushback on, are the insistence from the Welsh government that regardless of the type of land that somebody is farming or managing, 10% of it must go into sort of habitat recovery and 10% must go into woodland. So in effect, the response to that across the farming community is that it's inappropriate for it to be blanket treatment. But the problem is that because Welsh farms, like farms all over the United Kingdom, have been within the grip of subsidy for such a long time, to try and break those shackles is well nigh impossible. And therefore, with the combined pressure from supermarkets and the purchasers of what they're producing, but giving them effectively a deal with very little room for manoeuvre, and these sorts of measures is putting the farmers under absolutely intense pressure. So we'll just go on and have a look at the statement that the Welsh Parliament had made, or at least First Minister and the Farming Minister, Leslie Griffiths. They said just the day before the gathering that farming plays an important role in Welsh life. It's part of the economy, identity and culture, and that they're committing to supporting a successful future for Welsh farming. Is this really the case? From this same letter, they say that they're ensuring that actions are appropriately targeted at improving the economic resilience of farms, and specifically it includes ensuring woodland and habitat requirements do not make farms unviable. Well, that seems to be highly questionable because the way in which they're trying to push it out. Ensuring farm payments are distributed fairly and accessible to all, and considering an evidence-based review of any further and alternative proposals. Well, the proof of the pudding will be in the eating, and therefore they will have to pay attention to the responses to the consultation. They also say they're going to establish regular review points between the Welsh Government and the farming unions and representatives in formulating final proposals, and they'll carry out an updated economic analysis. Now, what seems clear at the moment is that there is no strong conduit between Welsh farmers and the Welsh government. The consultation is still open, but this is critical to the success of any campaign that's going to be run by Welsh farmers. Earlier in the week, I spoke to Gareth Wynne-Jones, a well-known farmer in Wales who's been very much part of the action taken so far. He has a large social media following across many platforms. And we spoke about some of the issues that have cropped up in recent weeks. So I'm just going to play you a clip now, which was in response to a question about the reduction of chemical inputs into farming, and essentially his vision for sort of wholesale change within the industry.
I think soil health is the most important thing. If we can use more regenerative ways, but we have to have a fair price for what we're producing. So, you know, if they've opened the floodgates like Westminster have to the Australian trade deals, and then we're struggling and scraping, you know, to produce different products without what they've got. And if you look into the Ukraine and Poland, they don't have the legislations for some of the sprays out there. So they can still spray with stuff that we haven't been allowed to use in this country for 20 or 30 years. And they're able to produce, you know, that crop and then ship it into this country and then challenge us. So it has to be a playing field that's fair for everybody. So these are important issues that the consumer and the customer need to understand. And once we can get their message out there, and I think it is beginning to resonate, people are starting to ask questions and they're beginning to look at where the food comes from and how it's produced. And these are all important things because we can build a better Britain on our bellies with a farming food revolution. And, you know, if we look at the way that we're producing the food, and the nutrient density of that food, as in, you know, grass-fed beef and lamb, there's a heck of a lot of, you know, nutrients in that. And for me, that's what we should be pushing over onto the next generation. And if we can get them to change the way they eat, move them away from fast foods and processed foods, you know, that is going to save the NHS in the long run billions, because we've got an obesity problem, we've got a diabetes problem in this country. And I do think a lot of this is down to dietary problems within the youngsters of today.
So Gareth, are very passionate, very well informed, and that's part of a sort of 20-minute conversation which will be released in due course. Now, one of the big issues that he brings up is first of all the sort of victimisation, as it were, of farmers used as apparently as a soft target by the Welsh Government, but also this blanket treatment of farms, as I mentioned earlier, as though all types of landscape are suitable for the same treatment, which is patently not a reasonable position to take. So we'll just have a sort of look at the overview of land in the UK. This is from a 2021 document, but what I want to draw your attention to is that permanent grassland down on the left-hand side accounts for well over half of all of the utilised agricultural area, which means that that is in effect going to bear the brunt of this. And of course, the knock-on is again, the sort of furtherance of the campaign against the eating of meat. So this is very much part of an agenda that's being driven from without the Welsh Government. And in effect, devolution may well have happened, but ultimately all of this is coming from the same place. We'll also have a look at other schemes that are already in place and really why is this necessary. Here we have from the Welsh Government the National Forest for Wales woodland sites. In 2020, they began the commitment to developing a National Forest for Wales. So in effect, there are already schemes in place to make this sort of thing happen. This is from the Forestry Commission, a graph showing tree planting since 1976 up to 2020. As you can see, the purple there represents Scotland, the deep purple. So the Scots clearly have been making enormous headway in this area, but Wales not so much at all. So in effect, it seems like they're sort of gone into panic mode and farmers are bearing the brunt of this. But it also highlights the complete sort of contradiction and hypocrisy within not just national, but also local governments on trees in particular. We have from the Forestry Commission a question sort of about felling trees and when it may be the right time to fell trees. And there are numerous examples from the press of councils, particularly urban councils, cutting trees down. Here we have from Plymouth, where UK Column, of course, is based, The Telegraph talking about the Midnight Massacre. We've got the Sunday Times going into a report about 110,000 trees being lost to council axemen. Couldn't resist including the authors because it includes Audrey Ash, but also the Camden cyclists talking about 50,000 trees being lost over the course of 5 years. So the point is, it seems to be one rule for farmers and a completely different rule for anybody else. And this is before we even start to consider the enormous infrastructure projects being conducted all the way across the United Kingdom, the removal of huge amounts of habitat and forestry to put in new roads and railways, housing developments with no regard paid really to the landscape and no sense of regenerating existing urban areas. And of course, also farmland that's being given over to solar farms. So the sense of priority is perfectly extraordinary. And the other thing that's never considered is the fact that the population of the United Kingdom has increased drastically over this period of time. And there's no regard given to the fact that we supposedly have a 60% percentage of food security within this country. Of course, a questionable statistic in the first place. But to suggest that we might be producing more food off less land for an increased population sounds utterly unrealistic. And so just a reminder of where this comes from. This is the then Prince of Wales's Terra Carta saying that one of the aims is that supporting the protection and restoration of a minimum of 30% of biodiversity on land and below water by 2030 and 50% by 2050. How on earth is that going to be made to happen? Mike showed this earlier, but if you want to follow this and find out what you can do and more about what's going on, the PFFA, I've forgotten the P now, Food and Farming Alliance, is meeting tonight on Zoom at their website, the-pffa.org. You can register and join that tonight. So that's where we are in the world of farming.
Okay, and that's where we are with the news for today. So I'm going to say thank you very much to Charles and Vanessa for joining us. We will be back in a few minutes if you're a UK column member for some extra stay on the stream. Otherwise, what day is this? Wednesday. Yeah, so have a great Wednesday and Thursday, and we will be back at 1 p.m. for another news program. Now, 1 p.m. tomorrow, we're putting out the interview that I did with Jose Vega. You saw a quick clip of that last week on the UK Column News, but the full interview will go out tomorrow, so do join us for that 1 p.m. Tomorrow. But otherwise, we'll see you on Friday. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.